Hello. In this audio snippet, we would like to continue talking about treachery or treason, because that seems to be what continues to linger in the air, especially in America. But before that, we wanted to mention a story that may be a little unrelated to the general topic of treachery, but at the end of the day, I would say it is related. So I'm going to click on it and here. And the story was posted on thegatewaypundit.com on the 20th of January, 2024. And the headline reads, "Journalist who tried to cancel Novak Djokovic for being unvaccinated collapses and dies suddenly at Australia Open." When I read this story, the first thing that came to me was the song "Bye Bye" by NSYNC. I started hearing the song in my head, "Bye Bye," because that's what I feel prompted to do. When I hear about these stories and look at the picture of the person who's died, I just wave at the person and go, bye-bye, bye-bye. sayonara, good riddance, you're gone. So let me just read the story here, part of the story. The sports journalism community is in mourning following the sudden death of Mike Dixon, a respected writer for the Daily Mail. Dixon, who was in Melbourne to cover the Australian Open, tragically collapsed and died shortly before his 60th birthday. And it's fitting. It is so fitting that he died when covering the Australian Open. As we read on, I guess you'll see why. Mike Dixon had a storied career spanning nearly four decades, during which he became a mainstay in press boxes around the globe. His journey with the Daily Mail began in 1990 when he first took on the role of cricket correspondent, eventually transitioning to become a prominent voice in the world of tennis. The sad news of his passing was conveyed through a heartfelt social media post by his wife Lucy on behalf of their children. The family statements reads, "We're devastated, blah, blah, blah. For 38 years, he lived his dream, covering sport all over the world. He was a truly great man, and we'll miss him terribly, blah, blah, blah." And 38 is a number of stagnation. 38 years. In the Bible, for example, they say, the Bible says that the Israelites wandered in the wilderness for 38 years. The generation that did not enter into the promised land, just wandered around in the wilderness until they died off. And this is what happened to this guy, literally. He wandered around in the wilderness for 38 years and just died off. And he died at the age of 59, just shortly before reaching his 60th birthday. It says here, in recent times, Dixon gained attention for his critical views on Novak Djokovic's stance on the COVID-19 vaccine. And I say that in quotes because it was never a vaccine by definition of the word vaccine, and also by its actual effect on people's lives. So it says here, through various articles, Dixon not only challenged Djokovic's decision, but also highlighted the potential implications for his legacy and public image. In one of his pieces, Dixon wrote, "Novak Djokovic could ruin his chances of becoming the GOAT by refusing to take the vaccine." And I say that again in air quotes. It's a strange hill to die on for a player who is so desperate to be loved. So, and this expression "goat" (GOAT) I don't know why it suddenly became mainstream to use that phrase, and the kids use it over and over and over again. GOAT, which stands for greatest of all time. But you know, I remember when I was a kid, they would say he was the GOAT of the game, and that meant that the player did something to lose the game for his team. So the GOAT was the opposite of hero. But somehow, in this upside down world that we are in now, being a GOAT is a good thing, which is fitting, because truth is now falsehood and falsehood is now truth. So he criticized Novak Djokovic because he wouldn't take the mRNA gene therapy injection. And then he also said later, why is the world number one so adamant about not getting the vaccine? How much is he giving up in the process? And more importantly, what happens now? Then he also wrote, Novak Djokovic will remain a hero to some, but to many others, he has trashed his reputation beyond repair. The world number one thought he could work the system, but it turns out favorable treatment only goes so far. So he was critical of Djokovic, and sadly Djokovic put out a tweet or whatever they're called now, or an X. I don't know what you would call it, but he posted something on the website formerly known as Twitter, and he wrote, "Condolences to Mike Dixon family. Rest in peace." He shouldn't have done that. Because Mike Dixon, he not only trashed him, but also put the lives of many people in danger by promoting the injection. And instead of, so he should have never, and if he didn't want to criticize him upon his death, then just be quiet. But don't try to act like, oh, you're above the fray. That sort of attitude is what leads to a lot of the compromise and lack of progress that we have in things, because we're constantly just trying to acquiesce and act diplomatic and let's all get along. And as we're all trying to get along, the problem continues to fester. If I'd been Djokovic, I would have pointed out, interesting, I'm sure, I heard that Mike Dixon died at an early age. I wonder if the injection had something to do with it. I would have done that. Would have gotten criticism, but who cares? The thing is that so this guy is dead. So all I say is bye-bye, you know, good riddance. The world is better off without him. He wasn't apparently as mean as or nasty as some of the other people who were promoting the injection and attacking Djokovic. But he joined the group, and in joining the group, even if he wasn't as vocal and direct and aggressive about it, he also deserves to be part of the punishment and the curse and the judgment that is on these people. So good riddance. I don't miss him, and the world is a better place without him. And now he must be aware that he was wrong. So this guy is dead. And he died covering the Australian Open, which is the open that most, the one, if I'm not mistaken, it was the only one of the four majors in tennis that prevented, that banned Djokovic from attending. He couldn't even go to Australia because he wasn't injected, or he couldn't stay there. That was how radical the moronic Australians were about the injection, self-destroying through that policy, and criticizing anyone who dared to question their stupidity. So it's fitting that he died covering the Australian Open, which was the one that most openly attacked Djokovic. And there's it is fitting and good riddance. So and this is related to the issue of betrayal in the sense that people who are in the business of journalism, because that's the beginning of this article starts with the phrase, the sports journalism community is in mourning. He was a journalist, and as a journalist, he had the responsibility to expose truth. That's what journalism does. True journalism exposes truth. It has no biases. It has no agenda. It's just there to expose truth. Whatever is true, it reports on it. And instead of acting as this exposer of truth, he became a co-participant with the trends in society and with the pharmaceutical companies. And instead of exposing what was going on, he joined the falsehood, the promotion of the falsehood. So he betrayed his profession by acting this way. Because to him, it was more important to get along with everybody than to follow the truth or pursue the truth. And it's ironic that he criticized Djokovic for wanting to be loved. He said it's a strange hill to die on for someone who is so desperate to be liked by others. But ironically, he was the one who was desperate to be liked by others, who wanted to be, he didn't want to be ostracized. He was surprised that someone was willing to pay a price of being rejected and alienated by everybody else. Like, why would you do that when you're supposed to be loved by everyone? You should do everything you can to be loved by everybody. And that's how he lived. This worthless fool lived his life. And that's why he was so, quote, beloved, because he always was trying to be loved by people. That's all he cared about. And that's why it's fitting that he came to an early death. And I may have missed it here in this article, but I don't see exactly what exactly he died from. And usually in these cases, they never give too many details about the cause of death. But clearly, did they say something about the heart? I'm not sure. Oh, yes. Well, no, the only appearance of the word heart seems to be in the phrase heartfelt social media post by his wife, Lucy. And Mike Dixon also felt it in his heart. As he was dying, he felt the consequences of the injection on his heart. And that's how he went down. And who knows where he is right now. But the thing is that he's gone, the truth and those who uphold the truth are grateful, that this idiot, is dead now. So, is that harsh? No, it's not harsh. This person was responsible for the death of who knows how many people, the people who listened to him, who had any hesitations about taking the injection and would read something posted by him, would then say, okay, let's go and get injected. And then their lives have not been shortened if they're not dead already. He's responsible for the destruction of the health of hundreds of thousands of people. He's joined all those who have blood on their hands from this injection. And by joining them, he joins them in the consequences and the curse and the judgment that is upon them. Then he participates in it, no matter if he was not as aggressive about it as all the others, but he joined them and he deliberately said, I am one of you. It's like saying, I'm one of you to the Nazi party. Even if you're not the one doing the putting the Jews in the ovens and in the gas chambers and all that, even if you're not the one shooting them dead, by you saying, hey, I applaud you, Nazi party, and I identify myself as one of you, at that moment he becomes co-participant of the judgment that is on the Nazi party. That's the same thing here. So, bye-bye, Dixon. The NSYNC song is playing for you. The world is a better place without you. Sad as it is, because you could have done your work as a journalist, but you betrayed your calling, and now you're gone. So, good riddance. So now that we've mentioned that, let's do the. We wanted to mention these seemingly unrelated, two other unrelated headlines, but we believe it's worth mentioning very quickly. This other headline that we wanted to share was posted on noqreport.com, which always redirects you to AmericaFirstReport.com. And it was posted on the 1st of February, 2024, a couple of days before this recording. And the headline reads, Russia Begins Building 15-Minute Cities. So I'm just going to briefly read parts of this article. It says, a new Russian city called Dobrograd is being built in the Vladimir region of Russia. It's being built according to the concept of a 15-minute city where everything necessary for a person to survive is within a 15-minute walking distance. Judging by the information on the website, construction of this has been underway for a year already. These cities are nothing short of enslavement, and yet the public at large still hasn't figured out what the ruling classes are doing to them, and Dobrograd is not the only one, according to a Substack article by Retko Dametko. Dobrograd is not the only one. On Sberbank's website, you can find a detailed presentation of another smart city, quote-unquote, and the title of the article hints at the same 15-minute city model for the World Economic Forum. So they go on. So you read the article, and they're upset about the city, and so forth and so forth, and that's the end of that. But the sad thing as I read this is they don't think beyond the immediate story, and they just criticize the story, but they don't think beyond that. And I say to myself, okay, these are the same people who are so adamant about Vladimir Putin being this champion of Christian values, and who is fighting the woke left, and these are the same people who defend Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and who see Ukraine as this corrupt country whose government should just surrender and try to make some sort of peace agreement with Russia and end it all and see whatever land the Russians want to take away from them. Because obviously Ukraine, in their view, is siding with Bite Me and is being supported by Bite Me and the liberals, and therefore it must be evil, and therefore Russia are the good guys. But if Vladimir Putin is such a defender of Christian values, as I've literally read some people, conservatives, and if I'm not mistaken, even conservatives who have posted on this website that I'm reading from. So I've read this, and if he really is such a defender of Christian values and fighting wokeism and fighting the European Union and the WEF and all the other Fs out there, if he's fighting all of this, why is this city being built? And there's no, they don't make the connection. They accept these two contradictory ideas and never question. Because questioning that would mean having to question their own understanding of the Russia-Ukraine war, and they don't want to go there. So they just isolate it, compartmentalize it, and treat this as something completely unrelated to the other thing they believe in. And it's interesting. It's and there's this fitting poetic irony to the fact that the city is being built in the Vladimir region of Russia. There's a region called Vladimir. So, you know, it's fitting because it literally points to Vladimir Putin, a region that literally bears his name. And that's where the city is being built. And you would say, well, more than most likely Vladimir Putin has nothing to do with this. And do you really think, a conservative, are you that stupid to think that this city would not be built, would be built without his approval? Do you really think that in Russia they could build a city like this without the approval of the great one, the great dictator Vladimir Putin? I mean, if you really think that, then you really are lost. And if this city is being built against Vladimir's approval, or if he's such a defender of Western values and so against the WEF and all that, why isn't he vocally attacking this and saying we should not be building the city if he doesn't have the power to stop it being built? So that's what is so sad about this, that it's just a manifestation of the stupidity of conservatives unwilling to see the errors in some of the core things that they're fighting for, and they have put their eggs in the Russia basket when it comes to the Ukraine war, and have touted Vladimir Putin as this savior of the West and of Christian values. They have no idea how Vladimir Putin suppresses Christianity in Russia. You can get arrested if you are preaching the Christian gospel out on the street. If you're a street preacher preaching Christianity, you can get arrested because you have to have a license. You have to do it inside a building. It's all very regulated. So he's okay with Christianity as long as it's well contained and he can control it. But God forbid that there will be a preacher out there saying something without authorization from the great Führer, Vladimir Putin. And he is, even so, the defender of Christian values in the eyes of conservatives. So that just shows you, and this seems unrelated to the topic of treason, but it is, to me, very related, because conservatives are the ones who are closest to the truth, at least in the American spectrum, political spectrum, and they claim to be defenders of the truth, who fight the lunacy of the left that is completely detached from truth altogether. And even so, they constantly betray the truth in very subtle ways by accepting falsehoods and then not using logic and truth to recognize their own mistakes. So they just double down and continue with their contradictory world, that willingness to accept two completely contradictory ideas, which is a manifestation of treason, of treachery against the truth. It's turning your back on the truth. But it's because at the end of the day, they are defending their idols, and they don't want to let go of their idols. And that's why they fall into these sorts of contradictions. And they're very subtle, but they are real. Another example of that stubbornness is this other headline that says, it was posted on the 17th of January, 2024 on thegatewaypundit.com, and it reads, "Breaking. Wisconsin legislature introduces twin constitutional amendments to permanently ban ranked choice voting in the state." So it says here, and it's a guest post by Jefferson Davis. That's what it says in the article. So I don't know if Jefferson Davis is the name of a person or a news website. Who knows? But it's interesting that the name of the person who, or the organization or whatever it is that posted this originally, apparently, is Jefferson Davis, because that's the name of the president of the Confederacy during the Civil War, a son of a bitch traitor. As treasonous as you can get, because he was leading the rebellion of the South against against the Union and against the United States. So it's interesting that this person has the name of a traitor. I mean, imagine the shame. It's like someone being called someone whose surname is Hitler. I don't know if there's anybody out there whose surname is Hitler. They must have, you know, already changed it. But if there was someone out there with the surname Hitler, imagine the parents deciding to call him Adolf. You know, I don't think anyone, even if they had the surname Hitler, would be willing to name their kid Adolf because of the obvious connection. It's interesting that if anyone out there you know, had the name Davis, to give their kid the surname Jefferson, the first name Jefferson, is a sign of where their mind is. It's interesting that that's who posted this article originally. I don't know if it's a person or what, but it's Jefferson Davis. That should be as repulsive to anyone aware of American history as Adolf Hitler or Eichmann or Himmler or any name like that. Or Joseph Stalin. It is an abomination. That son of a bitch is burning in hell as we speak. He's a worthless piece of dirt who wanted to continue the enslavement of an entire race of people. When the truth was saying, let them go, let them go, let them go. And this son of a bitch, along with millions of others, said, no, we shall not let them go. How dare you tell us what to do? And he was a traitor to the truth. And cursed is he and anyone who upholds his name. So the article reads, Wisconsin is joining a growing list of states, cities, counties, and other populated areas across America to permanently ban ranked choice voting. So they describe the details of that. They say here, the ranked choice voting concept has been around for decades in America. The arguments for the ranked choice voting usually fall along the lines of the following. Encourages more candidates, encourages more electoral participation, gets rid of the nastiness, gives electors more choice, will save our democracy, takes big money out of elections, is gaining in popularity, have runoffs until one candidate gets to 50.1%. The usual progressive liberal suspects support ranked choice voting, with the liberal big money donors hiding in the weeds to hopefully influence legislators and to control the optics, blah, 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 blah. It says it's well documented all across America that this concept is terribly flawed, is being repealed where it has been tried in many areas and has outright been banned in the following states. Okay, so this sounds a little bit like what liberals usually do when they attack conservatives. It's well documented across America. Really? Really? Where? Where is it well documented? You would think that the person who wrote this would take... He took all the time to list all the bullet points of why liberals support ranked choice voting. So you would think that if he took all the time to write all these bullet points that I just read, you know, encourages more candidates, encourages more electoral participation, blah, 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 that he would then take some time to point out what is so wrong with ranked choice voting. But it's not here. So, and all he says is, oh, this is being promoted by liberal big money donors. And is that his argument? That it's being promoted by liberals, hence it's wrong. That is his argument. And we have talked about ranked choice voting and why it's needed. But it's not just needed on its own. It is part of the solution to ending the party system altogether. They do. He does try to explain a few things here. Like I said, extremely confusing. My goodness, you have to be a moron to be confused by it. I'm sorry. Extremely confusing. There are many things about the Windows operating system that are extremely confusing. But people use it all the time. Extremely confusing is a very, very cheap excuse. He does say also, many runoffs possibly until one candidate gets to 50.1%. Well, that's what ranked choice voting does. It eliminates the need for runoffs. So I don't even know why he said this here. Then he says, very expensive. What? How? How is it very expensive? Much more work for clerks and poll workers? Really? Really? What? What? Very delayed results. What? Where is that coming from? Endless number of ballots destroyed or trashed during each runoff. So he's talking about runoffs, but the ranked choice voting system is supposed to be a way to eliminate runoffs. So it's like even this person doesn't even know what he's talking about. So he's throwing all these... he's raising up all these straw men and tearing them down and giving all these excuses. That's all he is giving. And then one of the other arguments, it's very confusing because he put all these bullet points of all these unrelated things together. And that's why I didn't see that he had tried to justify his point of view. But he says here at the end, ranked choice top five voting is not gaining popularity. That's one of the reasons why he's against it, because it's not gaining popularity. And that's one thing that conservatives always do. When they try to defend their point of view, we are the majority in this country. We're just the silent majority because the mainstream media is so loud. But our traditional values are supported and liked by people. And I always go, I'm sorry, but who the hell cares how many people support it or don't support it? In the South, if you went and took a poll back in the old days of how many people supported slavery, the vast majority of the people supported the slavery system. Did that make it right? No. Who cares whether it's popular or not popular? That has nothing to do with it. And when you have to resort to that, that means that you really are not too sure of what you believe in. And that's why you have to look behind you and see how many agree with you for you to be sure about what you believe and what you're trying to promote. You see what I'm saying? If you are convinced of what you believe, you don't have to look back to see how many support you. If you believe that 2 + 2 = 4, you don't have to say, okay, let's take a poll of how many people agree with me. I mean, you could be the only person on earth who believes it, and you still say 2 + 2 = 4, because I know it's 4. I've tried it a million times to add 2 and 2, and I always get 4. So I don't care how many people agree or don't agree with me. 2 + 2 = 4. And that's how people enter into the green zone, because it's people who are willing to die alone for what they believe in. They don't have to see how many are dying with them. They can die on their own and be at peace, for lack of a better expression, about it, because they know that they are dying alone on that hill or that mountain. And it kind of goes to what this Mike Dixon was criticizing Djokovic about. He was saying, you're dying alone on this hill. Join us, all of us. We are all getting injected. Why aren't you getting injected? And see, when you enter into the green zone, we've talked about white, red, black, and green. When you enter into the green zone, you don't have to see poll numbers. You're willing, and you derive your strength from the truth you believe in, and that's all you care about. But the reason why I'm sharing this is just to emphasize that conservatives are constantly criticizing the corruption of the Democrats and the party system and the rhinos. And they're always saying the rhinos, the Republican Party has betrayed us and all this stuff. And yes, and there's a lot of validity in what they're saying, but they never take the next step and say, okay, there's something wrong with this whole party system. Like, for example, when they complain that, Mitch McCaca gets elected in Kentucky all the time. Well, why does Mitch McCaca get elected all the time in Kentucky? Because when it comes to the voting in the Senate, for the Senate seat of Kentucky, the people of Kentucky have to choose between Mitch McCaca and some worthless liberal from the Democrat Party, because those are the only two options. The Republican option is Mitch McCaca, and the Democrat option is some other form of caca. So they have to choose between caca and macaca, and they go, well, at least macaca is not just a pure caca. It's a bit of, it has some Mac in it. So let's go for macaca. So you have to choose between the lesser of two evils, because that's what the party system enables. And if there was a better person out there, they don't make it through the Republican primary, because the Republican machinery supports Macaca, because Macaca has all these friends in the party, especially in Kentucky. So, and he also can say, I have national relevance, and I can raise Kentucky's relevance in the national stage, by me being present in the Senate. So I make Kentucky relevant to the country. If you elect me, my presence makes Kentucky a force in the national political scene. So he can say all that. He has the machinery, and then any candidate who challenges him gets drowned out. He doesn't get the money. He doesn't get the support, and everybody in the Kentucky Republican Party, turns their back on this other potential challenger to Macaca, because Macaca is a mover and shaker in Washington and does things for the party. So it's impossible for this extra candidate to come in and challenge Macaca. And therefore, the people of Kentucky have to choose between Macaca and Democrat Caca. And obviously, they have to choose the lesser of two evils, and they choose Macaca. And then the conservatives complain, why do we have rhinos in the Senate? Why do we have rhinos in Congress? Why do we have rhinos everywhere? Well, it's the party system. And ranked choice voting, which ironically is promoted by Democrats, is actually the part of the solution of ending the party system. And we've described this in detail. We won't go into all the details of what that entails. But we cannot have a clean system until the party system is destroyed. It's part of the clot shots. And it's ironic. It's fitting that we're talking about Mike Dixon and the so-called vaccine that is a clot inducing shot, and that is a representation of the clotting that we have in our political system, where we have power clots, and we've talked about this at length many times. And the party system, promotes these people who accumulate an unrighteous amount of power and control things. One person arbitrarily controlling things, and those are the power clots. And the way to end the power clots is by ending the party system. And the only way to then have reasonable elections, if there is no party system, is to have a system where candidates can join freely, and therefore you can have multiple candidates, and then you have to have a system that supports multiple candidates that freely join the process. And that's where ranked choice voting comes in. Yeah, it's a little more complicated than the normal system where you just choose one person, but we're not anymore, but we were a first world country with first world education, supposedly. So this was not a country of morons. Are we that stupid that if, if I can't not just choose one person, now I have the option of choosing more than one. Oh, my brain is going to explode. I can't process that. I can't grasp such a deep concept. Oh my goodness. Yes, it's a little more complicated. You have to think a little more. That means you have to think about the candidates out there. You have to be interested in hearing more voices and say, okay, I like this guy. And if this guy doesn't win, I want this guy. That's what ranked choice is. It's saying, you know, your top three or four choices that you want. It's a little more complicated, obviously. But that's what is needed in a system where there are no parties. So yes, the Democrats are promoting ranked choice voting, but they want to keep the party system in place. But conservatives, just because liberals are promoting it, therefore it must be evil. And that's their thinking. That's why they're against Ukraine in the Ukrainian war, because the liberals are supporting Ukraine. And when you start doing that, you start betraying the truth, because everything is, oh, I'm just going to do the opposite of what my enemies say, without thinking, without asking the truth. Truth, is this the right thing or not the right thing? It doesn't matter who's saying it or why they're saying it. Is this still true? But so it is an example of betrayal, that stubbornness, the stubbornness that leads to betrayal. Because you're holding on to idols and you're unwilling to recognize that you're wrong. And if I read this article that was posted supposedly by some Jefferson Davis, I still don't know what that means, if that's the name of a person or what, but it's so poorly written. I mean, there is no real argument here clearly made about why it's a disaster. They do mention the issue of why of the Alaska elections, where Sarah Palin lost in a ranked choice voting process. But we talked about that in some detail many audio snippets ago. It was really not, that was not the reason why she lost. She would have lost anyway. In fact, the ranked choice voting system actually gave her a greater chance of winning. And we kind of, we made an effort to talk about, to explain that many audio snippets ago. But in the conservative mind, it's like, oh, no, Sarah Palin lost, ergo ranked choice voting is evil and is a way to prevent Republicans winning, conservatives winning. No, what happened was that there was another conservative there who was fighting, and he was splitting the conservative vote with Palin. And it had it been a standard election system, then Sarah Palin would have lost by even more, because she would have had her support divided. Ranked choice voting actually prevents that sort of divide and conquer strategy that happens many times, where what liberals do is sometimes convince a moderate to run. They kind of, through manipulation, get the moderate to run, and I use the term loosely. And so it's an alternative to the right wing conservative, and that moderate starts splitting up the support of the right wing conservative. And because we have a system where it's only one person. The person who gets the most votes, even if they get 20%, if that's the largest percentage, that person wins. So what happens is that the vote gets split, and then the person who is a liberal ends up winning, because the liberals don't split themselves. They are always a united front. Conservatives are the only ones who start splitting amongst themselves. So the thing is that this is an example of that stupidity, the stubbornness that leads to betrayal of the truth, where you don't want to admit the truth. And you turn your back on the truth because you're holding on stubbornly to your idols. Another article that's related to betrayal is this one. I'm clicking on it, and it was posted on the Jerusalem Post on the 20th of January, 2024, some days ago. And we had wanted to get to it before, but we hadn't been able until now. And it says, Blinken is using blackmail to achieve goal of Palestinian statehood. So it's an opinion article, opinion piece, posted on the Jerusalem Post, and it's saying Blinken, I think he's the Secretary of State. I mean, I couldn't care less anymore, you know, who is what. So sometimes some of these names that would in other times be well known to me are a little bit of a blur. All of this whole regime that's in power in the White House is just a fraudulent regime. So that's why I really don't care who is what, because it's all illegitimate. But Blinken apparently is the Secretary of State. So it says here, in his need to be clever and come up with new creative ways to achieve the goal of Palestinian statehood, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has now resorted to the threat that, quote, Arabs won't pay to rebuild Gaza without a path to Palestinian statehood, unquote. In short, Blinken is making it clear that unless we want to absorb the full cost of rebuilding Gaza, we're going to have to offer to make nice with the Palestinians by incentivizing their willingness to take on the massive restoration project. And under what framework would that incentive come? Being agreeable to the acceptance of a Palestinian state alongside the Jewish one. While some might call that a fair exchange, I would call it financial blackmail, knowing full well that Israel cannot afford to take on such an expense when it has its own immense burden of rebuilding all of the southern communities that were destroyed by Hamas terrorists, necessitating the evacuation of those residents. Since that time, Israel has had to pick up the tab for housing tens of thousands of kibbutz members, as well as residents of northern and southern communities where it remains too risky for citizens to live. Add to that the staggering costs of war, dubbed Israel's most expensive war ever. Billions of dollars have already been spent in the fight against Hamas. Ynet has reported the war has already cost some NIS, I'm not sure what that is, shekels, I guess, $217 billion, which is $60 billion U.S. dollars, which includes both the cost of the military operations and the broad financial assistance to the economy, including compensation for businesses, paying for property damage, and supporting tens of thousands of evacuees from the Gaza and Lebanon frontiers. According to the report, just calling up 360,000 reserve soldiers cost around 1 billion shekels, I think it is, or $264 million. So the financial burden of fighting terrorism doesn't come cheap, an important detail which Blinken is dangling in front of Israel. So so this post continues talking about why the Palestinian state is a dangerous idea and so forth. But what I wanted to emphasize here is a few things. First of all, this is the most expensive war that Israel has ever engaged in. And it just keeps going. And it's only been going on for October 7th. So that's November, December, January. We're into February. So we're going on 4 months since the attacks of October 7th. And it's still going on. They haven't been able to rescue the hostages, they've already spent $60 billion U.S. dollars, the equivalent of $60 billion. So that's why this is to emphasize that yes, there's always been conflict in the Middle East, and Israel has always been under threat and all of this. So, but the attacks of October the 7th. Had a dimension that were completely different from anything Israel had ever experienced before, and it's being manifested in the cost of the war, and And that is to emphasize how the veil of protection has been removed. It has been removed. So Israel and the Jews of Israel, you have to recognize you have been playing around with the truth, taunting the truth in the sense of saying, oh, yeah, we're going to play with you. No, we're not. Yes, we are. No, we're not. Yes, we are. No, we're not. We're with you. Oh, no, we're not. And the truth said enough is enough. And your protection is gone. It's gone. It's not. You will not have it back until you stop dancing. And that's why this war has gone on. And yes, you could say, well, they've had this massive success against Hamas, but yet the terrorists are still holding the hostages. A lot of hostages are not being returned. And Netanyahu is getting frustrated. The pig Netanyahu is getting frustrated, and it just goes on and on and on. And now there's a chance of escalation with Lebanon and going into Lebanon and doing all these extra things. And now Iran is rattling its sabers and attacking U.S. ships and killing U.S. soldiers in America, because now it's no longer a first world power. It's just cowering, not doing a thing. Because the Iranians have no reason to fear America. America is dead. America has died. It's gone. The person writing this article who wrote this. This was written by Kuki Schwaber Isan. So, with a name like Kuki, who knows what this person is? It might be a woman. I don't think a guy would call himself Kuki. But okay, let's assume it's a... Oh, okay, let's call this person a person. We have no idea whether it's a man or a woman. But this person is stating all these things that are valid. But this person is not thinking at a higher level what this all represents. And it just shows the unawareness. These people do not understand that the veil has been removed from them and why it's their fault. See, and it's not because they haven't treated the so-called Palestinians or the Jordanians correctly. It has nothing to do with that. It's how they have treated the truth, not how they have treated the quote Palestinians. They have brought this on themselves, and it will just go on and on, and they still don't get it. They just don't get it. I'm scrolling through this article, and people and he's explaining why it's a stupid idea to have a Palestinian state. Let me just read one paragraph that this person wrote. What is completely missed by him, however, is that Israel's acquiescence to Palestinian statehood is tantamount to signing its death warrant, because as in the well-known fable of the scorpion who asks a frog to help him cross a river because he can't swim, the hesitant frog agrees only to face death after being stung. When asked by the frog why he stung him, the scorpion's response is, "I can't help it, it's my nature." In this case, even before October 7th, we already had an inkling that it was in the nature of Palestinians to sting Israel. But if we were ever doubtful, that tragic day made it painfully clear that Israel has no real partner when it comes to the concept of peaceful coexistence and living side by side with mutual respect. So yeah, it's all true. But the solution, at the end of the day, is for Israel to align itself with the truth and decide which side do you stand on. To stop playing around with the Christians and saying, yeah, we take your money, but we still believe that you are the followers of this false Messiah, of this false cult. Either side with them or say, hey, we're not going to take your money anymore. We're going to rely on our God and wait for our Mashiach to come, and he will rescue us. And we're willing to stand all alone because we're not going to take a one dime from you apostates and followers of this fake Mashiach. I mean, either do that or recognize this person as the Mashiach. Do something. But you can't play around with the truth. You can't use people that you disdain and disagree with when you need them, and then disdain them when you don't need them. You can't play around with the truth like that. So, but you read this article, and you can see clearly they're not getting it. Just like the conservatives in America are not getting it, the Jews in Israel are not getting it either. And they have all betrayed the truth in one way or another. The conservatives in America, because they cling on to their stubbornness, and the Jews in Israel because they want to continue their dancing with the truth instead of defining themselves either for or against something. So another story that's related to things we've talked about before was posted on thegatewaypundit.com on the 29th of January 2024. And the headline reads, Slim is back. Upside down Japanese moon lander recharged batteries and resumed lunar mission. So there's a picture of the lander. And apparently the picture was taken by some sort of device that came out of the lander and onto the lunar surface and took the picture, because otherwise, there's no one there to take the picture. So how do they have a picture of the lander? Well, that's apparently how it happened. So they have a picture of it, but the lander is upside down. But there's something kind of funny about that. And in a certain sense, I see it as a picture, literally, of Japan, the condition of Japan, upside down. Where up is what's up is facing down, and what's down is facing up. And I see it as someone who has his head buried in the earth. Someone who, and that's what the Japanese have done. They have buried their heads in the earth, like an ostrich. They say that ostriches don't really do that. I really don't know. I haven't asked one. But apparently they don't do that. But, you know, we'll just say it as part of the, of the expression that we normally use. So they have, like the ostrich, they have buried their heads in the sand, in the earth. And that's how they live their lives, this focus on the material. And we had mentioned that SLIM was an acronym for I forget what SNL we said had meant, but IM we had said meant in the material. It's people who are immersed in the material realm. That's why they try to lift up to a spiritual level what is purely material. And that's why Japanese have this great obsession with robots. I don't know if you've noticed that, but I've always been amazed at how obsessed they are with robotics. And the reason why they're obsessed with robotics is that it's their effort to believe that something that is intangible can be reproduced by the tangible. That's why their heads are buried in the sand, in the sand of the earth, of the natural realm. They don't believe that there's something metaphysical about life in the human that can never be reproduced through robotics. And they try constantly to prove that they are in the truth by trying to replicate the metaphysical through physical means, if that makes any sense. And that's why this lander ended up like this. Instead of looking up towards the metaphysical, they keep looking down towards the earth. And that's why their heads are buried in the sand. And that's why their lander ended up upside down. It says here, the module performed a historical and very precise lunar landing a little over a week ago, but ran out of electricity because it ended up upside down in the moon's surface with solar panels facing the wrong direction. But apparently on late Sunday, the 28th of January, JAXA, I'm not sure what that means, must be their version of NASA. JAXA finally reestablished communication with its smart lander for investigating moon, SLIM. Then it says here, the spacecraft touchdown made Japan the fifth country to put a spacecraft on the moon after the Soviet Union, the U.S., China, and India. The probe was able to generate power again thanks to a change in the sunlight's direction, JAXA said. It says here that the lander touched down within 55 meters or 180 feet of its target in a crater near the lunar equator on January 20th. And apparently this was a big feat because usually the landing is not as accurate as that. They usually land many yards or maybe even miles away from their intended target. But in this case, they were able to land it within 100 meters of the target because usually the range is several kilometers, apparently. So that was a feat in and of itself, but they landed upside down. So despite their accuracy, it was kind of a meaningless accuracy because they landed in a wrong way. But they were able to kind of start up operations because the sun light hit the panel somehow. But I'm not sure what's going to happen and will they be able to do much after that. It doesn't really say here in this article from what I can gather. So I'm not sure exactly what this all represents, why they were able to start up communication again. Is that a sign of maybe Japan someday awakening to the truth? I don't know, but it's interesting that the story about this lander resurfaced in the news because the lighting, the sunlight finally hit it, and it was able to kind of start up again. But how much is it going to achieve like that in that position? I'm not sure if these landers are supposed to are they supposed to stay there forever on the surface? I'm not sure. Because obviously it won't be able to take off from the lunar surface if it's upside down, obviously. But it was able to restart. What is it going to do? And how long is the energy going to last? Who knows? But Japan is an example of a people who have always been unwilling to recognize their mistakes, what they did wrong, as we have mentioned before, with them being unwilling to recognize the horrors that they committed during World War II. And how that leads to betrayal. So they have betrayed the truth in a certain sense, where and they remain a land that is very dry. It's a culture that's very, very dry, very empty, because they want to fill their metaphysical emptiness with physical things. That's why they're obsessed with technology, and that's why they're so advanced and so. But even with all their technology, all their economic success, they're still an empty society. They don't have cultural richness the way we had in America before we died as well. They never had any of that because they remained obsessed with the material. And they turned their back on the truth in that way, and they've remained, and they have a heart that's unwilling to recognize that they've done wrong. And that's why they're in the condition they're in right now. And another story we wanted to share, and I'm getting the sense that we're not going to be able to say many of the things we wanted to say, that, and especially in regards to the judiciary, that's what we wanted to get to, the betrayal that's embedded in the judiciary system in America. But we wanted to share this story that appeared, a very peculiar story that drew my attention. It was posted on the New York Post on the 20th of January of 2024 as well. And the headline reads, America would be vastly different if FDR hadn't pushed this man out. And I deeply resent the way the headline is phrased, and you'll see why in a moment. So the article begins by saying Henry Agard, or Agard, I'm not sure how to pronounce that name, A-G-A-R-D, like guard without the U and then with an A at the beginning. Henry Agard Wallace, the 33rd Vice President of the United States, was a peculiar fellow. He didn't drink, smoke, or swear. He didn't like telling jokes, reading fiction, or playing golf. In fact, he hated any pursuit in which he could discern no scope for self-improvement. While highly intelligent, Wallace struggled in social situations. As author Ben Stile explains in The World That Wasn't Henry Wallace and the Fate of the American Century, Stile believes Wallace actually had Asperger's syndrome, a form of autism spectrum disorder first highlighted by Austrian physician Hans Asperger in 1944, Wallace's final year as vice president. According to Stile, Wallace remains the most fascinating, quote, almost president in American history. And in, quote, The World That Wasn't, unquote, he imagines how different America would have been if Wallace and not Harry S. Truman had succeeded Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1945. So the fellow was born on a farm in Orient, Iowa, in October 1888. And they start talking about him. And it says here, like farming, politics also ran in the family. His father, Henry Cantwell Wallace, was U.S. Secretary of Agriculture under Presidents Warren G. Harding and Calvin Coolidge, which happened to be a Republican, which is interesting. So his father worked in two Republican administrations. And then it says here, Wallace held the position himself under Roosevelt from 1933 to 1940, and then served as FDR's vice president from 41 to 45. So he was also Secretary of Agriculture, but with a Democrat. So I'm not sure why his father worked for Republicans and he worked for Democrats. And so it says here, while it seemed likely that FDR would ask Wallace to be on his ticket in his bid for a third term, his left-leaning views, especially regarding the Soviet Union, spooked some moderates in the Democrat Party. So the thing is, FDR picked this guy as his vice presidential running mate for the 1940 election for his third term. So he had already been ruining the country for 8 years, for two terms. And usually the tradition was that the any president would not run for a third term, just like Washington had done. And no president ever wanted to run for a third term because they didn't want to promote the idea or the concept of a lifetime dictator kind of thing. So they would always step down after two terms. But FDR, who was a traitor and a dictator, he was a dictator at heart. He just never had the chance to fully manifest the monster that was in him. But he was a monster on the inside. He said, oh no, I'm running. And so he ran for a third term. And for that, when he ran for that third term, he picked this, son of a bitch as his vice presidential, candidate. But remember, it's 1940. So 1940 means that the war was already going on in Europe. Hitler had already invaded Poland and the war had started. And Russia was involved. I believe Russia and the Soviet Union were in some sort of pact at the beginning, and then Hitler kind of betrayed Russia and attacked them, and then Russia then became an enemy of Hitler, of Germany. But so this was all going on in Europe, and then FDR decides to pick this son of a bitch to run for his treacherous third term, and he picks a guy who was left leaning and who liked the Soviet Union, and he was his health was already beginning to falter even more, so he knew that if he picked someone, there was a chance this guy was going to be the quote president of the United States, yet he picked this man. So it says here, let me see if I can, it says here, let me see if I can find more comments on this guy's political views. It says here, the doctrine was, let me see. He was very, very supportive of the Soviet Union. It says here, first, he wrote a book detailing his belief that the Soviet Union was experiencing a renaissance under the Bolshevik regime, and he did so with the help of a known KGB informant. Then in 1948, he made an unsuccessful bid for president under the Progressive Party and colluded with Soviet leader Joseph Stalin, even allowing the dictator to edit an important election speech. Wallace also struggled with the Truman Doctrine of 1947, which was aimed at containing the threat of Soviet expansion. The doctrine was a red line for the former VP, and it constituted, according to him, the clearest possible evidence that the president had allied himself with fascists and reactionaries in Congress, the military, and the State Department, unquote. only a person who is a full-blown commie could talk like this, full-blown communist. I mean, who else would praise the Soviet Union as a place of renaissance? You know, the place where Stalin was murdering millions of people and sending them to the gulags in Siberia if they dared to oppose him. This was the place that he was calling a place of renaissance. And he even allowed Joseph Stalin to edit one of his important election speeches. This is the guy that FDR chose as his possible substitute in case he died during his third term. That tells you a lot about what was in FDR. And it also tells you that FDR was very happy with the Soviet Union himself. Wallace is an outside reflection of the monster that was inside FDR. It's as if you took the monster inside FDR and projected him to the outside world. And that was Henry Wallace. And that's why FDR, son of a bitch, was burning into hell this week. And I hear him screaming. And it's like these, this sincere pain. I don't know how to explain it. That's what I hear, sincere pain. And it's a constant moaning. This son of a bitch was burning in hell. He did not want to attack to end the war quickly when he finally joined because he was pussyfooting all the time. And then he finally joined, and he started, there was a campaign in Africa, and they could, and Churchill kept saying, hey, we need to attack the belly of the beast and go in through Italy and attack Germany, because Churchill knew that it was important to protect Europe from being taken over by the Soviet Union. He didn't want the oppressor just to switch from being Hitler to Stalin. He wanted oppression to end. So he wanted to rescue Europe before the Soviets could get a chance to invade and conquer territory and take it away from Hitler. But FDR kept saying no, no, no. And you know why he kept saying no, no, no? Because to him, it was a good thing that the Soviet Union would have a chance to take up territory and spread communism throughout Eastern Europe. That's why he did. He was friendly with the Soviets. That's why he always was against. And then we ended up doing the Normandy invasion in 1944, which is very, very difficult and very deadly. It was much easier to go in through Italy. We could have gone in. We had a base. Mussolini was very easy to overcome. And once he was overcome, then it was just a matter of just charging up. We had a footing in Europe with bases that we could have. Logistically, it was very easy to set up in Italy and then just push into the heart of Germany. But no, we had to do it all, you know, pussyfooting around. Like, okay, we have to do it through France. And France was very strongly protected, but we did it anyway. And then when we finally did it in 1944, then it was 1 year, less than 1 year later, the war was over. So we could have ended the war many, many years before it actually ended, if it hadn't been for son of a bitch FDR. He prolonged the war, and we just kept dancing around and fighting in Africa, conquering useless territory. Yes, there was an initial need to conquer portions, take portions of Africa away from Hitler, so we can then go use that as a launching pad into Italy. But once that was achieved, then there was no point in fighting in Africa all this time. But FDR just played around because he was giving the Soviet Union time to conquer Eastern Europe. That's what he was doing. Son of a bitch, worthless bastard, polio boy was doing this. And Henry Wallace is a reflection of that. FDR was a traitor. He was a traitor to this country, just like Henry Wallace was a traitor to this country. FDR was the ultimate traitor, masking himself in weakness and vulnerability, like this man who was just here to help us all. But in all this time, he was destroying this country. He used the Great Depression as an excuse to start increasing the tentacles of government and doing all these horrible things that have made our lives much more difficult and that have led to the strain on the economy that we have now, where now it's all ballooned to $34-35 trillion of national debt. He began this whole process of the fast decline of the American Republic. That's what FDR stands for. I felt the need to share about this man. To be frank, I was not aware of him. It's such a horrible thing that he was so dangerous. That such a dangerous man was one heartbeat, literally one heartbeat away from being the president. Can you imagine what would have happened if he had been the president and the war ended? The Soviet Union would have felt completely free to run amok across the world and spread even more communism all over the place. So it's a shame to it's a manifestation of the evil of FDR that this happened. And the thing is that in 1944, FDR was already getting very sick. And he did not, but he wanted to go for a fourth term. because, you know, he was so full of himself. I mean, he was worse than Trump in terms of narcissism. This guy was full of himself, and he wanted to be elected for a fourth term, and he ran, but he knew that he could not win with Wallace because the Democrats around him started complaining that, you know, Wallace is he's so openly communist and so openly pro-Soviet Union that you're going to antagonize a whole bunch of people. And they finally convinced him to take Wallace off the ticket. And that's when he put in Truman. And Truman ended up winning, becoming president because, as you know, FDR died, went to hell in 1945. And then he became the president, and then he got reelected. He won the election of 1948 against I forget Stevenson. I forget the name of the other guy. And the famous headline, the newspaper headline that said that the other guy had won because they did a premature printing of the results of the election, and Truman surprisingly won that election in 1948. And this article talks about how the world would have been different if Wallace had not been Wallace had been the vice president, and it would have been a very sad world. But the thing is that I resent the headline because it says America would be vastly different if FDR hadn't pushed this man out. As it makes it sound like this man was imposed on him, and he had to forcibly push this man out. No. This man was... that's what bothers me about this headline, because it doesn't point out that FDR was the one who picked this guy, who knowingly selected him as his vice presidential candidate, and he did not continue with him for his fourth election, because... of how unpopular this guy had become in the public eye. So it's not that he pushed him out. You know, the other people around him, the Democrats around him, were the ones who pushed this guy out, not FDR. So, but see, that's the thing. Even these, the New York Post is kind of a neocon kind of publication. And even when they do, but they are part of this whole, group of people in America that still idolize FDR. They think of him as this man who rallied America in the midst of its struggles with the Great Depression, when in fact he was the one who prolonged the Great Depression through his policies of the gold policy. We've tried to explain this before. He kept the money supply very limited. And that's why the economy just couldn't get back started up again, because the money supply has to reflect the amount of goods and services in the society. We've said this before. It has nothing to do with Keynesian economics. It's not that. It's that the money supply has to grow exactly in the same proportion as the goods and services. It has nothing to do with how much gold is out there. What does the amount of gold have to do with how many goods and services are there out there? The money supply has to be a reflection of the points. It's a point system that reflects how many goods and services are out there. So it has to be consistent with that, with those goods and services, not with how much gold is out there. Who the hell cares how much gold is out there? What matters is how many goods and services are available in the society. And then you define a point system consistent with that. And also on top of that, of the gold policy, he also began to he kept preaching this message of malaise, but it was malaise with this message of, oh, we are here to help you, and people never had the people were constantly psychologically trained through his constant Sunday radio broadcasts that we were in terrible shape, that our country was in bad shape, but I'm here and nothing to fear but fear itself, and we'll get you through this, and we will set up a social program for this and social program for that, and we're going to get you through. And people were in this state of, yeah, things are bad, instead of him explaining to them what had happened and why the collapse had happened and the economic collapse of 29 had happened and what needed to be done to kickstart us again. And that's why when World War II came, and we needed to produce, and he had no choice but to get people to produce, then suddenly we started producing, and the economy roared back to life. How? Why would a war improve the economy? I've shared this with you before. It's always been a puzzle, was always a puzzle in my mind as a kid. I never understood why would a war make our economy better when wars are supposed to be a drain on our resources. You know, war is expensive. War costs money and costs lives. It's nothing. Economies don't prosper because they are at war. But in our case, it ironically produced prosperity because it forced FDR to get people to produce again, like telling them, hey, you can get back to work again. And that's when the economy roared back to life, because we all always had the potential to produce again. It's just that we were being stymied by a man who kept telling us how crippled we were. You can't walk. You can't, just like me, you can't walk. You have polio too. You have polio too. You can't walk. And everybody just kept thinking, yeah, we can't walk. We can't get back up again. And he kept holding back the money supply through because he tied it to gold. And that all led to this malaise until World War II came. So FDR has always been hailed by many people as this great man. And I used to admire him when I was a kid, I must say, because I fell for the propaganda. But as time went on, I realized, oh my goodness, this guy is no hero. This guy is a zero. Actually, not even a zero. He is he's below zero, because he was not only useless, he was very destructive. And he laid many foundations that have been undermining and destroying our country from within for decades. And he's responsible for it. He is the ultimate traitor. He pretended to be something he was not. He was Henry Wallace in disguise. He always was. And the only reason why he took him out for the fourth term is because he knew he couldn't win with him on the ticket. And he put him on the third term because he knew he also couldn't win with him in the first and second tickets. So he had to choose someone who was not exactly like him. It was like by the third term, he said, now I can be myself a little more. So that's why he chose Wallace for his third term. I'm not sure who was his vice president in either of the first two terms, but on the third term, it's like, I'm going to show you who I am now, because now I've been winning and I have people's trust. So now I can start being myself a little more and show a little bit of the monster that I am. And he chose a man who was evil, an ultimate traitor to his country, who was asking Joseph Stalin to edit his speeches. when he tried to run for president in 48, and it's interesting to me that you know, his father was a Republican, and then he himself became a Democrat. There's something, there's a turncoat kind of theme going on in his life. A man who betrays, who turns his back on things. And by the way, it says here that this guy was a very mystic person. And this ties in some peculiar way to Japan, because the weird thing with Japan is that they do have this obsession with the material, trying to prove that the material can substitute the metaphysical. But at the same time, they also have these very weird cultist sects. Mystical stuff that they believe in, like in the very extreme, because they have a very visionary nature to them. They just hide it constantly from themselves. And visionary people have to aim for the metaphysical. You can't be overly pragmatic and materialistic and be a visionary. So they have that, and they repress it, and it kind of manifests itself in some pockets through this very deep mysticism. So this guy was this Wallace fellow was a very mystic dude. It says here, raised as a Presbyterian, he nevertheless found Christian orthodoxy, quote, wishy-washy. Instead, he turned to spiritualism, exploring Buddhism and Zoroastrianism. And it says here, he would come to confess himself a sort of, quote, practical mystic, unquote, a man in search of eternal truths, which, whether gleaned through calculation or introspection, could inform the path to positive social, economic, and political change, unquote, writes Steele. Steele is some writer who wrote about him, Steil. For Truman, it was more reason to jettison him. Wallace, the president would write in his memoirs, had transformed into a mystic with a zeal that verged on fanaticism, and that he said would cost me votes. So in other words, Truman didn't like Wallace because he was like a crazy mystic fellow, verging on fanaticism. He was a nut job liberal and a nut job mystic. But it's kind of interesting. He was a practical mystic, it says here. A man in search of eternal truths, which, whether gleaned through calculation or introspection, could inform the path to positive social, economic, and political change. So, and there is a certain validity to that mindset. You have to search for eternal truths, and they will have a practical consequence on Earth. He was just searching for the wrong, he was looking in the wrong place for the truth. And clearly, if he thought that the Soviet Union was a place of renaissance, his concept of nirvana and what an ideal world, pragmatic world would be, was a little off by, you know, he missed it by this much. Just like Maxwell Smart would say, if you know who he is, he missed it by this much. And obviously he's burning his in hell. Not sure if he's right near FDR or maybe in some other section of hell, but the son of a bitch is dead too. And he, and burning there. And he is a, he is the outward manifestation of what FDR was on the inside. FDR was the ultimate traitor, to this country. And we just needed to mention that. And interestingly enough, this also correlates with what we said about Ireland, because and the Celtic people, because lo and behold, if you look it up, Wallace, I'm looking here at the Wikipedia article on the surname Wallace. It says Wallace is a Scottish surname stemmed from the Anglo-Norman French Wallis or Welshman. It is a northern variant form of Welshman. And it says here, it originates from Old Low Franconian Wallisk, meaning foreigner, Celt, Roman, which is a cognate of Old English Woolish, meaning foreigner or Welshman. The original surname may have denoted someone from the former kingdom of Strathclyde who spoke Cumbric, a close relative of the Welsh language, or possibly an incomer from Wales or the Welsh Marches. The kingdom of Strathclyde was originally a part of the Hen Ogled, its people speaking a Brittonic language distinct from Scottish Gaelic and the Scots language derived from Lothian. Variations of the name include Walla, Wallace, Wallis, Walling, Wallace, and blah, blah, blah. So lots of variations. And in modern times, in the 19th and 20th centuries, the surname has been used as an Americanization of numerous Ashkenazic Jewish surnames, which is interesting. But the thing is that Wallace is a Gaelic name, clearly. And as you know, that's the name of the man, a famous Scottish person. And I forget his name. The guy from the movie with Braveheart, you know, with Mel Gibson. What was his name? I wish I could remember, but you might be saying it right now as I'm trying to think of it. But the thing is that it's a Gaelic name, and it goes to that connection to betrayal that is embedded in the Gaelic race for some reason. So it's not a coincidence that he was Gaelic, and it's part of what we said about Irish treason, you know, thinking of the Gaelic people in a wider sense. I believe that we won't get to talk too much about other things here. We wanted to speak in greater detail about the judiciary, excuse me, and how the judiciary is betraying the country. I believe we can talk about a couple of things before we end this audio snippet. And it has to do with the ambiguity in the judiciary branch of the Constitution. So let's very quickly mention this article here from the dailymail.co.uk. And it was posted on the 1st of February, 2024. The headline reads, Groundskeeper 49 from Pennsylvania is awarded record $2.25 billion after jury finds decades of using Roundup weed killer caused his blood cancer. And it says here, adds billions to payouts to Americans who claim product caused blood cancer. Manufacturer denies health bodies warnings that ingredient is a carcinogen. Roundup is this weed killer that's been used for a long time and suddenly was associated with cancer somehow, and then everybody, and then all the lawyers saw, like sharks smelled blood in the water, and they went after a Roundup, and they've been able to get millions and millions of dollars from it, literally billions. And in this case, one person getting $2.25 billion. And you go, okay, so this Groundskeeper 49 is being paid $2,250 million. And if I do the numbers, $2,250 million, that is equivalent. If we take 60,000, it might be a little more now, especially because of inflation. If we take $60,000 as the annual average household income in America, that means that this guy is getting the equivalent of 37,500 years worth of an average American household income. 37,500 years. What this one person is getting. And you say, well, I don't know the technical details of whether or not there really was a link that this Roundup thing caused his blood cancer. I don't know. And that's not my point here. Whether there is a connection or not, the question is, where the hell does that number come from? And by the way, it says here that the sum was broken down as $2 billion in punitive damages and $250 million in compensatory damages. Where did this number come from? Why? Why out of nowhere $2.25 billion to this one person? And by the way, his name is John McKivision. McKivision. John McKivision, and clearly a Celtic name, interestingly enough. These things are all interrelated. There's some sort of like linkage to all of this. It's very peculiar to me. The question is, where does this number come from? And again, if the if a Roundup were promoting or selling this supposedly deadly product, knowing that it was going to kill people, then the question should not be how much money can we get from them. The question should be who should be put in jail, because lives were taken supposedly by this product deliberately by people who sold a deadly product to make money. So clearly then people should be in jail. But why aren't people put in jail? First of all, because it doesn't pay for the Bentley that the lawyers want to buy. It doesn't pay for the Rolls Royces and the mansions that all these lawyers want to buy. But second, it's a reflection of how little respect we have for the right to life, because the right to life is the violation of that right to life should lead to criminal penalties, not just to financial penalties. If you kill a life, you should be in jail because you have violated a very fundamental human right. And also, for example, going off topic a bit, when these big financial claims are made because of libel or slander or whatever, it's also a reflection of how little respect we have for the other fundamental right to a fair reputation. We've mentioned the five fundamental human rights. And the right to a fair reputation is also something that is so sacred that it should also come with criminal penalties. But we have so little understanding and respect for that right in the Constitution, because the Constitution doesn't understand that right, doesn't even understand the right to life, as we've explained a million times, that instead of punishing someone with jail time when they really do commit that crime, of that violation of a right, instead of that, we just ask for money, and that's all we ask for, and we just see if the guy has deep pockets, and then we take advantage of that person and demand money from them, because obviously they wouldn't be demanding $2.25 billion from Roundup if Roundup was this small company that couldn't possibly pay that amount. It's always that if they see someone rich, they try to take advantage of it. And the number goes higher because the person is richer. Well, obviously, you committed the same crime, then you should pay the same amount, because the crime is still as evil. It doesn't. Why would it be more of a crime if you're richer than if you're poorer? So if you're poor and you kill someone, does that mean that you should be punished less than a person who is wealthy and also kills someone? It doesn't make sense. And people should be going to jail if they really were promoting a product that killed people, but no. So this goes to not only the problem with the judicial system, the ambiguity leads to all this treachery going on, people taking advantage of the ambiguity to betray the system and take advantage of it and rape it and mutilate it. But on top of that, we have the emptiness of this lack of clarity on what our rights are, and therefore people who should be punished if they really were guilty are not being punished, because the people who did this over who knows how many years, they're already retired. All the executives at Roundup who supposedly sold all these products for so long, they made their money. And they went home, and they're retiring. They're living in a golf course, playing golf somewhere in Florida, and living the high life, supposedly. Living off of the benefits of what they did to all these people. I'm assuming, just for the sake of argument, I'm just assuming that they really did do this evil deed that's being claimed here. But who is being punished? They're not being punished. It's the company being punished. The company, they are no longer connected to the company. So they were able to get away with it. Now the company is suffering, and the company has employees right now who make a living, who depend on that job for income right now, and they're the ones being punished for something that was done many years ago. There's a certain falsehood in the whole system. It's a system of that has a lot of treachery in it. And again, we hear these amounts, and no one does pardon my French, a damn thing about it. No one says, okay, this has to stop. I mean, for crying out loud, yes, this guy, his life, if it really was the case that he got cancer from Roundup, he's going to be, his life expectancy cut short by 30 years. But I don't think this guy was going to produce $2.25 billion of wealth for the world in his lifetime. I'm sorry, I don't think he... Actually, I think he's more of a... There's something about him that seems a little bit unrighteous about him. There's something unrighteous about this man. And I think he's more of a taker than a giver. That's what I perceive in this man. He's more of a taker, and who knows, the world might be a better place with him dead. But he's enjoy $2.25 billion. Is that how much his life was worth? $2.25 billion? And this is money that has to come from somewhere. It's not coming from the pockets of the people who supposedly did the evil deed. It's coming from the pockets of all the workers at Roundup, all the people who sell Roundup, everybody who's been associated with Roundup in one way or another. Places, stores that sell agricultural products, they are affected also, because this has a ripple effect in many sectors. Many people's lives are being punished to feed this guy $2.25 billion. There is something arbitrary about it, and this, again, as we've said before, when you have ambiguity, it just opens the door for betrayal. Just like, for example, if you have a contract with a person who is a cheater, if you don't define things clearly in the contract, traitors are going to use the contract as a weapon to take advantage of you. And that's what we have in the American system over and over again. And the conservatives are never willing to recognize, hey, we have something wrong in our system. The founding fathers were not too clear in so many things. We have to clarify them and correct them. But instead of that, we continue on this path of denial. And that's why the country is dying. And just to finalize this, another story related in the same concept. It's an older story from December 16th, 2023, from last year, from the time of this recording. We had been wanting to get to it, but we had not been able to get to it until now. And the headline read, city coughing up $825,000 for infringing farmers' religious rights. This might sound like a positive story, especially to a conservative, but it's actually, again, a sign of something that's wrong with the whole system. This was apparently originally posted on the WND.com website, and it was posted by a fellow named Bob Unruh, or something like that. It says here, a Michigan city is coughing up $825,000 because its officials infringed the religious rights of a local farmer by banning him from a market event. Officials with East Lansing also have agreed going forward to protect the religious rights of the owners of Country Mail Farms. The payment includes about $783,000 in lawyers' fees and another $41,000 in damages. Let me repeat that. So, you hear the payout, $825,000. Ooh, that's a lot of money. But $783,000 of that is for lawyers' fees. And then $41,000 in damages. In other words, I'm getting from that the farm All the farm got was $41,000. And the lawyers got $783,000, over three quarters of $1 million from a small city. So this city is now has been financially kneecapped by these lawyers, and things that they could provide, services they could provide, they will not provide because they will have to be paying all these lawyers, all these fees. Yes, they might have committed a wrong, but there's something wrong with this solution. So, okay. So it says here, it was a few months back that a federal district court decided Steve Tens, I'm not sure how to pronounce the name. It's almost looks like Tennessee. It's T-E-N-N-E-S. So it's Tennessee without the C at the end. Interesting. So he might be a traitor too. Steve Tennis, let's call him Tennis, the farm owner, was free to continue participating in the city's farmer's market after city officials had banned him. It was back in 2017 that city officials excluded Tennis specifically because of his religious beliefs. Steve and his family run farm, happily serve all customers as a valued vendor at East Lansing's family market. The court was right to agree that the First Amendment protects Steve, like every other small business owner, to operate his business according to his faith and convictions, lawyer Kate Anderson said in a prepared statement. We are pleased to favorably settle this lawsuit on behalf of Steve, obviously, who would be happy and pleased with $783,000 in their pocket. So they're pleased and to favorably settle this lawsuit on behalf of Steve so he and his family can continue doing what Country Mill does best, as expressed in his mission statement. Quote, glorifying God by facilitating family fun on the farm and feeding families, unquote. The fight, like so many these days, erupted over the farmer's dedication to biblical standards. He posted on Facebook that he follows the Catholic Church's teachings about marriage, including when he allows weddings at his family's farm. That statement of faith prompted city officials to create a new policy that refused him permission to be at the farmer's market. WND had reported when the ruling was handed down that the court found Tennis and his family had been forced by the city to, quote, choose between following their religious beliefs and a government benefit for which they were otherwise qualified, unquote. The case has been in the courts for some 6 years. The court decision had found, quote, denying a person an equal share of the rights, benefits, and privileges enjoyed by other citizens because of her faith discourages religious activity, unquote. And it says here, Country Farm is a 120-acre second-generation family farm in Charlotte, Michigan. They had sold organic products at the East Lansing farmers market since 2010, but in 2017, city officials decided to target them with a discretionary system of individual assessments, unquote, for participants. So this story sounds like a victory for conservatism and blah, 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 and religious liberties, blah, blah, blah. But it's really more of an example of what's wrong with the whole system. Where how can these lawyers become $750,000 richer off of a small city in Michigan as a result of this? Why weren't the people who, see, the thing is, there should be prosecution for the officials who violated this fundamental liberty, religious liberty. It shouldn't just be the city paying. Who is paying this? The taxpayers. It's not coming out of the pockets of the officials who passed the bill, that was used as an excuse to ban these people from this farmer's market. Correct? It's not. It's going to be the citizens of the city, including the Christians who live there. Including Country Mill Farms, who in some way is going to be part of the payment, because they're only going to get $41,000. They also have to compensate as part of this, you know, as members of the population. Somehow, the other $783,000 that the lawyers have pocketed has to be compensated somehow, and it will come from the pockets of the citizens of the city. Fewer roads will be fixed, fewer parks will be built, and there are going to be consequences. And this goes again to the problem of how ambiguous our system is. Again, where does this number come from? And why aren't the people who committed this crime, because this was a crime, people's rights were being violated, the officials who committed the crime, they get away scot-free. And there are no consequences for them. So we have a system where people who are supposedly committing crimes, violating human rights, are not punished in any way. But we have this layer where we have an institution paying up on behalf of the people who really committed the crime. Like in the case of Roundup, assuming, I'm not saying that they were guilty, but assuming that they were, that they really killed people, now it's the company, the intermediary, that's paying the price, not the people who really committed the crime. There's something fundamentally wrong in the system. There's an ambiguity there. And all these dollar amounts that come out, why aren't the officials, the city officials who passed the bills, paying the $783,000 in lawyers' fees? They are the ones who cost the city that amount of money. Why aren't they being punished for what they did? There are no consequences. And because of that ambiguity, the treachery continues. They try to get away with these things, and if they get caught, they just, they can say, it wasn't me, you know, and someone else has to pay for their misdeeds. So all of this points to how wrong things are in our system, and how it just is conducive to treachery, constant treachery. We'll continue talking about this ambiguity in the judiciary system in a future. Not only in the judiciary branch, but in the legislative branch, there's this ambiguity on how responsible we hold people in these branches, and that leads to this opens the door for a great amount of treachery, and we'll continue talking about that, and also talk about federalism and how that also has been enabling treachery and treason in our system for all this time. But we'll do that hopefully, if the truth allows it, in a future audio snippet. Thank you very much for listening.